Eugene, I personally will look forward to the results next year.
Yes.
See what happens. Our next speaker, our last speaker, is Hillary Schwant.
Very good.
Oh, thanks. Hillary got both her master's and PhD at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. And she's going to tell us about the Go Girls initiative in Botswana, Malawi, and Mozambique. And she does monitoring and evaluation for a variety of African projects.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Hillary, as Nancy said, and I'm presenting on behalf of myself and Carol Underwood, who couldn't be here today. And we are part of the Go Girls Initiative, which is a project in Botswana, Malawi, and Mozambique. Neither of us have any relationships to disclose. And I'd like to start with a little bit of background. Adolescent girls in sub-Saharan Africa are 3 to 5 times more likely to be infected with HIV than their male peers. And due to this disparity in HIV prevalence in this region, the Go Girls Initiative was designed to reduce adolescent girls' vulnerability to HIV. We were guided from the beginning of the project through to the end of the analysis by the social ecological approach. And this is really important for us because we know that girls are vulnerable not because of their own individual choices that they make, but because they are surrounded by family and peer networks, their communities, and their society, which burdens them and also constrains their choices. So the project focused at all of these levels, not just the individual level. We had an extensive research portfolio in this project. We started with a literature review to define girls' vulnerability to HIV. We noted that people often talk about orphans and vulnerable children, and orphans is easy to define, but vulnerability is much hazier, so it's difficult to define, so we started with a literature review. And then we did formative research with community members in the target areas that we were working to discern what their perspective of was on girls' vulnerability to HIV. We did a baseline survey to establish the baseline indicators prior to doing any intervention. We had an extensive process evaluation throughout program implementation, and we did an endline survey to measure the reach and the effect of the program. So some findings from the research. The literature review, we found that girls most vulnerable to HIV are those who are orphans, early school leavers, socially marginalized, migrants, live in impoverished conditions, have low HIV knowledge, have low self-efficacy, consume alcohol, and have weak relationships with adults. For this presentation, we're focusing on the school aspects of our findings. So early school leavers was a big finding for us. In the formative research, just to give you a little bit about the methods, we did focus group discussions in November and December of 2008 with these different groups, young girls, adolescent boys, adult men, women, and community leaders. And our findings. When examining community views on girls' vulnerability, we found that the findings were proximate, intermediate, and distal. So the proximate finding was that they recognize the role of unprotected sexual relationships, often age disparate, concurrent, and transactional, as placing girls at proximate risk to HIV infection. At the intermediate level, we found that community members identified weak relationships with adults problematic. And yet the preponderance of comments identified structural factors, insufficient economic, educational, socio-cultural, and legal support for adolescent girls as the root causes of girls' vulnerability to HIV. Just to say that most of the comments throughout the focus groups were at the structural level. So some examples from some illustrative quotes about the unsafe school environment that came out during the focus group discussions. For example, the teachers might want to conquer a girl and tell her, "I want you." And if the girl rejects him, he might tell her, "Well, then you will fail my class." And so the girl will have to accept it. And so they will probably not use any protection, and the girl can become infected with HIV. The girl might try to ask him to use a condom, but the teacher will never accept it because the teacher is the one that asked for it. And another quote, therefore, he tells the girl that he has fallen in love with her, but if she refuses, he tells her that she will fail her exams. After thinking about all this and the feeling that she will fail her exam, she just gives in to the demand of her teacher, which is aligned with the finding that Eugene presented just prior. So we also, at the end of the focus groups, we asked community members, after they had described girls' vulnerability at these different levels, what can we do? What can communities do to reduce girls' vulnerability? And their solutions, like the problems that they presented, were multifaceted and multi-leveled. So they said we need to improve adult-child relationships in the community. We need to increase economic opportunities for girls and their families, help girls stay in school, and improve and enforce regulations on alcohol, violence, rape, and teacher-student relationships. So moving on to the program, we use the literature review and formative research to inform our program design. So we had a few structural program components. We had school personnel training and economic strengthening at the structural level, community mobilization at the community level, and adult child communication program at the family level. I'm just going to talk about the school personnel training today. So the audience for this training were teachers and school administrators, and the objectives were to create safe school environments and strengthen staff as protectors, change agents. So to really highlight their role as role models and protectors of girls. There were 14 sessions, and they covered these different topics: gender equitable teaching practices, teachers' code of conduct, power, coercion, and consent, and also knowledge about HIV/AIDS. We expected that school personnel would become aware of how they can make schools welcome places for girls so that they would stay in school longer. We disseminated the code of conduct that was at the national level so the teachers would know that it existed and that they could, that it should be respected. We strengthened the PTAs and the community councils in the communities. And the expected effect there was that girls would be more likely to stay in or return to school if they had dropped out. So we have a few findings from the process evaluation here. After the training, we interviewed participants, and this is a quote from one of the school training participants. Apart from the skills that I learned, there's another which I feel is important, that is the code of conduct, which was covered during the training. This will greatly assist me in staying away from behaving immorally with girls and make it possible for me to contribute more fully to the community. We did a pre-post test with the participants. So we had a number of statements, and we asked participants to indicate whether they strongly agreed, disagreed, or they didn't know on a number of statements. And then we had the same exact statements, give them the same exact statements at the end of the training. And this is just one of the statements about what is sex and what sex versus gender. And we found that there was an increase in knowledge about what gender, the difference between sex and gender at the end of the training in all three countries. Okay, on to the surveys. The surveys were quasi-experimental separate samples design. The sample size per country was 800 adolescents and 500 adults at baseline, 400 adolescents and 400 adults at endline. So we, during the intervention, we had a lot of positive results about the training from the teachers. And throughout the program period, we went back to the teachers and we talked to them about the schools. And we heard a lot of positive things about changes that were occurring at the schools. And we also heard from community members that they had recognized changes as well. We knew less from the girls' perspective. So the surveys were nice in that we could assess from the girls' perspective if there had been any changes in school. So we asked girls if they were feeling safe at school, and then there was this Likert scale, very safe, somewhat safe, neutral, not very safe, not safe at all. And we could assess by whether the school had received the school intervention or not. And we see that across all three countries, when comparing the girls who were in the intervention schools compared to those who are not in the non-intervention schools. Those in the intervention schools were much more likely to say that they feel safe. And this is only at Endline. So this is after the program implementation. Also, interestingly, we asked if there had been a difference, or if there was a change in teachers offering sex. So if it increased, if it stayed the same or decreased. And in Botswana and Malawi, comparing the intervention schools with the non-intervention schools, we find that girls in the intervention schools were much more likely to say that there were fewer teachers asking for sex, or it was happening less often. So in conclusion, our research has shown that, our research in the past has shown that girls who are not in school are more vulnerable to HIV than their in-school counterparts. And our program experience shows how a simple intervention with school personnel can create school environments that are perceived as safe for girls and can reduce teachers' exploitation of adolescent girls. And these are both important factors in keeping girls at school. Thank you.
I don't know about you all, but I think we've had 5 excellent presentations, very diverse. I think one of the things that holds them together is that they all show superb use of research to sound research to collect evidence before making behavior change and media decisions. I'll open it up to questions. Please direct your questions at any one of the panelists. Any questions?
I have a bunch of questions, so I can start with one first.
Stand up so we can hear you, please.
I have a couple of questions for Eugene. I'm struck by your discussion of positive discipline. We have some work going on in Northern Uganda dealing with similar issues. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the cultural issues that you face in terms of getting people to agree what is positive discipline and what isn't. And also, if there's any evidence from, I know you're waiting, but from this doorway approach previously, that it brings about change. And then I'm also struck by your focus, or the part of the project that talks about how children can prevent this kind of violence. And I would be interested to hear some concrete things that you can teach children to do to prevent.
Okay.
On the positive discipline, that's something that came about as we began introducing the project to the teachers. They especially on the issue of corporal punishment, they said, well, if we are going to reject corporal punishment, then what are we going to use to enforce discipline in the classroom? And so the alternative that was proposed was the use of positive discipline, so to reward good behavior rather than punishing improper behavior, and this was done both with the teachers and the students. So it's important that the students also are brought into the discussion, so that they see that they have a stake in promoting positive discipline in their schools. So in each of the target schools. We have these roundtables with students and teachers to say, what can we do what can students do to create a positive environment for learning where they don't have to worry about violence, and what can the teachers do on their part? And on both sides, they came up with ideas of roles and responsibilities of each to create a positive environment. And so far, it's been embraced much more readily than I had expected on the part of the teachers. And what we're finding is that teachers are asking for more support in this regard, more training, and more ideas that they can share with their students. So that's been very encouraging. What the students can do on their part, we focus a lot on how students can raise these issues with their peers and with their parents, so that it's often a taboo topic, but when we have these large community meetings where students and parents and school authorities are all there, and we can get the topic out there, begin a discussion around it, then the students feel free to raise these issues with their parents and with teachers in their school, trusted teachers, the local teachers that we've designated in each school, and they're finding that they have ways they can, steps they can take on their own part to protect themselves. For example, they can form groups to walk together to and from school. That's a simple way to try and reduce the vulnerability going to and from school. And then in the schools, students are now feeling comfortable that they can report if they see a case of harassment or abuse. They feel that they now have a responsibility to report those incidents, whereas before they didn't feel comfortable. They didn't know who to report to or what process they should follow. Those are some concrete steps that the students have been taking.
Thank you. Do we have other questions?
Could
we move on to some of the other panelists, and then maybe we can get to that later so that if there's other questions, then we'll get to you afterwards. Okay, go ahead.
I have a question for two of them, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
One is a question for Shu Liu. I was struck in your final slide that you didn't mention that seeking information on health is correlated with better knowledge. You mentioned the TV news viewing, and I was just wondering if you have, or maybe I misunderstood or missed something in your presentation. The other is for questions for Basil Saffi. I wondered how you were planning to evaluate the impact of the communications campaign, especially on the role of marriage and delaying the first child.
Thank you very much for your questions. Because our study is basic, like we said, we have many, many media channels in Taiwan. And so the government, they try to use the media and to teach the people about the health education. So media is very important tool. So we think if people are exposed to more media use, they might get better knowledge. So the one thing is when they watch the TV news and they saw some people just say something about the recent finding about, for instance, that HPV vaccine. So people will learn from that, it's a passive way. The other thing is they're active to looking for some health information. So they will look at like the internet. Or we have several TV programs, it's outside of the TV news time. We have TV health education program, just teach people regularly, like several times a week. And there are several channels, they have similar program. So if people watch TV more time, they might have more opportunity to exposure to the health information. So we think as because of the gender role, we think the female, they might be able to seeking for the health information, then share with the family or as the caregiver. So the female is very important. So we want to know how they use the media, the frequency, and what channel, what type. Even if it's TV, I want to know which channel you watch first and most. And so we find that if they watch TV more, or they have the habit to looking for the health news always or most of the time, then they will be more likely to exposure to the health information.
Okay. And I think if you ask her afterwards, they do have good data on seeking. But maybe afterwards you can come up.
Yeah. I'll speak loudly. I hope you can hear me. It's a very good question. And in terms of the way the IFPS project is set up, it's actually meant to be a full implementation at the state level. So we have communication strategies associated with each of the states specifically, and that have separate evaluations attached through those for which JHUCCP helps conduct the instrument and provide technical assistance for the collection of that data. At the national level, unfortunately, there is no national communication strategy for family planning and reproductive health. That's something that has been relatively decentralized in India over the last few years, but I understand that USAID has a plan to start establishing a national communication strategy over the next coming years under a new mechanism that they've created. So in terms of your question about the evaluation of that mass media program specifically, unfortunately, since we're accessible to both the government and USAID for things like mass media, we're often used on an ad hoc basis. So there will be, you know, the evaluation that will come of this specifically is likely to come, an age of marriage, for instance, is likely to come out of the upcoming NFHS collection, which will measure things like age of marriage and others. But unfortunately, as the national level efforts aren't tied to a specific communication effort, you saw Mr. Roy has his own project communication strategy, and each of the states has their own. At the national level, propensity score analysis to see if there's if it can be attributed to this campaign, but unfortunately it is one of the weaknesses in providing sort of ad hoc, non-structured national level assistance, whereas the project was designed to be state level where you implement it and also evaluate at the end.
It's time for one more question.
I have a question for Mr. Roy, actually. I was wondering what went into the decision behind focusing solely on IUD promotion as opposed to focusing perhaps more broadly on healthy tapping and spacing and offering a mix of methods and encouraging women to choose the method that's right for them.
The thing is that, I mean, once you decide, I mean, how, I mean, once you find out that what are the determinants where you are going to work, it's important that, I mean, how you are going to, because some of the determinants, let's say, for another project myself, at least is related to condom use. Whether it's easy and viable to promote or to work in the determinants through mass media, or is the media, through one-to-one. So the decision is that depends upon the determinants and the target audience. So that way the programmer to decide that, I mean, what to address and what are the media that you need to work on. Yes.
I think we have time for your comment. I'm sorry to have cut you off, but I just wanted to.
I understand. It seems like that the referral teacher, the go-to teacher, is such an important element.
This project builds on a previous USAID project in the same region, the Ambassadors for Health Scholarship Program, where we had trained a cadre of mentors, primarily teachers, who already had this working relationship with a lot of the girls in the schools. So that was a natural place to go to recruit these focal teachers. But in addition, we recently found that we need to add both a female and a male focal teacher in each school. So that's the next phase, is to recruit and train male counterparts to play that role, so that girls and boys both feel comfortable going to this focal teacher.
So maybe next year we can have a whole panel on this subject. It seems like we want girls to stay in school, but it's dangerous for them to be in school. So that's kind of a Catch 22. Thank you all for coming. I think we should give the whole panel a big round of applause.